Hey, it's Greg. This is the Square Pizza Pod, cooked up by Sherm Co.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Square Pizza Pod. Today's episode, we have a special treat for you all as Greg is in conversation with Nehemiah Frank, who is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Black Wall Street Times. The Black Wall Street Times was founded by Nehemiah in 2017. He is the descendant of two families that survived the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. This prosperous community was a victim of the worst act of racial violence against Black people in American history. As a means of honoring the victims, survivors, and descendants, Nehemiah named his publication the Black Wall Street Times. The Black Wall Street Times maintains a hyper-focus on issues affecting the city of Tulsa and the Greenwood community, or Black Tulsans. In this episode, you will learn more about his family background history, the Black Wall Street Times, articles and publications, the Grammys, and his connection to the Square Pizza Pod, and so much more. We hope you guys enjoyed this one.
Probably something like, what'd you have for breakfast today, Mr. Frank?
Today I had eggs, oatmeal, a boiled egg, and toast.
It's a pretty good hearty breakfast there.
Yeah.
Big breakfast guy, is that consistent?
I usually have eggs every day. So
okay.
Yeah. What about you?
You go eggs or egg whites?
Definitely the entire egg.
No shame. Nope. No shame. I usually don't do breakfast, if I'm gonna be very honest with you. Usually just like rushing to get from one thing to the next. However, I have started this like eating oats in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I think they're just like semi-fancy oatmeal. But still good, and it keeps, and I usually don't finish it. So then I can get like two breakfasts, you know, one day on a Tuesday, one day on a Wednesday. And helps me with my efficiency and some of my other type A issues I have going on.
I gotcha. This is the most important meal of the day, so they say.
That's what they tell me. I know, so I might need to reconsider. So I might need to reconsider some of my choices. But that's a longer podcast episode, and luckily I'm not the guest today. Nehemiah, you're coming from Atlanta, is that right?
Yeah. So I am. I live in the Atlanta metro area. I'm originally from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yep. And how are things going in Atlanta today?
The sky is pretty nice and it's sunny and it's not raining and the weather is pretty warm. So I think it's a nice day.
It's perfect. And I think, this original connection we made before we get deeper into you was from the wonderful Jason B. Allen, who was previously on the Square Pizza Pod, episode number 77 for our listening friends out there. Wow. But curious how, you know, the one and only Mr. Jason B. Allen.
Yeah, so Jason and I, we are both in the education activism space. Mm. We met through a company called, or an organization, nonprofit called Education Post a few years back. And then after, you know, that kind of ended, I started working with the National Parents Union as a parent advocate, and I figured, you know, this would be a good chance to pull him over because he's always going hard for parents. Mm-hmm. So I recruited him over to the National Parents Union, where he now works full time.
That's incredible. Yeah, we really enjoyed getting to know him and follow him along the way as well. And so I saw that transition he made, and we follow NPU through some of the work we do on the family empowerment side, and we're fans of them and you all before, and now that, you know, Jason joined everything else, pretty incredible as well. So Nehemiah, I mean, we want to spend a lot of time talking about the incredible work you and your team are doing at the Black Wall Street Times, but if we could start even before that, can you just tell the listening community kind of who you are, what brings you to this work?
Yeah, so I am Nehemiah Frank, founder, editor-in-chief of the Black Wall Street Times, proud Greenwood descendant of families that survived the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. And prior to running the Black Wall Street Times, I was a full-time teacher and an assistant principal at a school in Tulsa.
And what got you into education?
You know, I always kind of had, I think I've always kind of wanted to be a teacher. Same thing with journalism. I didn't think that my path would actually fall into it because that's not what I majored in when I was in college. I majored in political science, but it kind of panned out pretty well because I have to write a lot while I run the Black Wall Street Times. And I had to become very meticulous when it came to editing students' papers. Yep. So,
yeah. What did you happen to teach, English?
So I taught English for a while, but I also taught fifth grade. And in fifth grade, you have to teach everything. So
very true.
Yeah.
That's great. And for, you know, some of the people, unfortunately, out there don't know much about the Tulsa massacres and what happened in 1921. I know that's so much of what your work does to uplift it. So if you don't mind, just maybe sharing as much as you want or as little as you want to bring some of the listening audience up to speed about what happened in 1921.
Yeah. So on the eve of May 31st, a young Black man was accused of assaulting a white girl in an elevator. They were both teenagers, by the way. And the white girl, her name is Sarah Page. She never pressed charges, by the way, against Dick Rowland, who was accused of assaulting her. And back then, if you're a black guy, you know, even looking at a white woman could get you killed. You think about Emmett Till, you know, simply whistling at a white woman was, you know, ended his life. And so that was kind of the situation in Tulsa. You know, it was a mob that formed after yellow journalism slipped into the local paper saying "nab Negro" for assaulting a white girl. The next thing you know, in a nutshell, a mob of 10,000 white men are ascending into Greenwood across the Frisco Railroad tracks, which is the line of demarcation, racial demarcation in Tulsa. And they essentially burnt the entire community dubbed the Black Wall Street to the ground. And they did that within 18 hours.
And so much of your work, even before the Black Wall Street Times, but now is using that and creating that platform to tell those stories and others focused on equity and civil rights in current day America. Is that fair?
That is absolutely fair.
And can you maybe walk us through a little bit like that progress from being a teacher and assistant principal to launching this really successful publication?
Yeah. So while teaching, which is already a more than a full-time job, right? You're going home and you're still working.
Yes.
The summertime you're working. On the weekends, you're working, so you don't really, you know, have a life. I'm a little crazy. I like to work a lot. And I saw that there was this disparity in local reporting when it came to our stories as African-American people. And then also, I mean, if you look at the Trump era, you kind of learn that the media is a powerful place. And if you can get your hands on a media company, or you could be a social influencer, you may actually be able to affect policy or maybe even affect critical movements that need to happen in your community. You could get people to be more civically engaged through mobilizing them. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty much what happened with the Black Wall Street Times. At first, when I put it together, I didn't quite see it that way. But little did I know, I was standing in front of a waterfall, and now, you know, I feel like I'm kind of on top of it, looking down like, wow, you know, we did all of that in a span of 7-6 years.
Wow. Yeah, certainly something to be proud of, right? Just starting it, leading that work, and, you know, one founder to another, knowing how much it takes day by day, to your point, then eventually looking down and just pausing at one point and not working for one Saturday or Sunday to understand how far you come is pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Thank you.
And the work is so strong, and I want to go deep on a few articles, but what really stuck out as we were learning more about you, you know, the tagline, right, of the Black Wall Street Times, access is the new civil rights, and really a powerful statement. You know, I think I know what that means from my work in education, but wouldn't want to presume, but curious why you guys felt so strongly about that as the tagline and how that reflects the work you all do at the Black Wall Street Times.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that information is powerful, first of all, right? And those who don't have it can miss out on opportunities to mobilize economically, right? Or perhaps critical information about their health if they don't have access to what's going on at the local school board. Then, you know, they don't have a voice in what's taking place. And so we wanted to make sure that the Black Wall Street Times was free and accessible for everyone. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, the main newspaper, it costs money. You got to pay for a subscription, and not everyone has a bank account. Not everyone has the financials to be able to make sure there's enough money in their bank account every single month so their subscription stays current. And, you know, with African Americans already having a disparity when it comes to employment and pay, I didn't want our readers to be able to have to worry about that.
Yep, that's really powerful. And I know it's, I think, a national scope, obviously, if not international, from our history. But some of the work continues to focus in Tulsa, specifically given the education system and some of the challenges happening in Tulsa. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Yeah. What sort of changes? And I know you guys have seen a number of remarkable things as a result of the work. Curious whether it's in Tulsa or elsewhere. Some of the outcomes you all have seen from the powerful information you're putting out through the platform.
Well, I would definitely say that because the centennial, which marked 100 years since the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, and maybe just a few months up to the centennial, which was May 2021, I would say that we were pretty local at the time. And you have a few Hollywood movies come out. You have The Watchmen, HBO's The Watchmen, Lovecraft Country, which they expose this, what was supposed to be swept under the rug, story of what took place in Tulsa, of this angry mob coming in and killing all of these Black people and, you know, burning down their businesses. And a lot of people were just like, oh, I didn't even know that this happened. And so once that happened, that's when we started kind of getting more people from around the country to start focusing on our work. We started subscribing. I think we got like 25,000 subscribers in like a week's time, which is insane. We didn't have to pay for them, which is amazing.
Good for you.
And so I kind of felt this responsibility to not just report on what's happening in Tulsa, but to report on what's happening beyond. I believe that everyone should have access to a platform to elevate the issues that are happening in their communities. So now the Black Wall Street Times has become this national news publication. You know, so we went from local, you know, with me just investing $300 into this little local blog to, you know, I was on a White House call earlier today with, you know, Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms and some other people that work for the Biden administration.
Wow, it's incredible. And we still got you to join the Square Pizza Pod. I don't know if we deserve that.
Regarding what's, you know, what the president's going to be talking about during the State of the Union address.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you at liberty to give us any insights about what you learned on that call?
Well, we put out an article today.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, readers are free to go there and check it out. And you don't have or anything like that. So,
perfect. Yeah, we can share that in the show notes. Absolutely. Well, that's incredible. And so much of that access is critical. And I think, you know, calling out one, if not two articles, you know, fairly recently, the article you guys put out focusing on the College Board defending AP African-American Studies course. I think this caught wave in Florida, but so many other states are wrestling with this now as well. And I want to ask you to share more about the article. But what I appreciated was, one, your guys' perspective on it, which, you know, the truth and the honesty, but also as a former teacher, the clarity in which you broke down the different units to really lift up what is actually in the curriculum and what is not. you know, from my understanding, likely dispelling any false myths that could permeate by somebody just saying this is what it is without actually going deep into it, which I think that misinformation is unfortunate in our current times.
Right.
But I really appreciate the level of writing that detail. I'm curious if you want to share, add on more about that piece that you guys put out.
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot of, I think a lot of negative publicity around the College Board's new recent revision of the AP curriculum. Mm-hmm. So much so that you have governors that are saying that, you know, because you changed the curriculum, we, you know, we're probably not going to use the AP history course. But it's like, okay, well, all of those students are not going to have the ability to learn about African-American studies at a college level. Like, you're denying them that because you think and you didn't do the research, you know, or even ask if the teachers have the capacity to be able to allow them to learn about these controversial issues. Sure. And so the way that it was written, we were able to get our hands on the first curriculum that came, the first pilot curriculum that came out last year, and the new revision. And yes, there are differences, but a lot of those differences are kind of written in an ambiguous way to where if someone wanted to learn about critical race theory and bell hooks theory, they could still learn about it. Now, they might not be able to learn about it in Florida based on the way the laws are written in that state. Mm-hmm. In Oklahoma, unfortunately, House Bill 1775, which was signed into law, would prevent students and teachers from engaging in that type of classroom discussion. But most of it, it's pretty intact. Mm-hmm. Black queer theory is still in there. People are saying that it's not. But if you look at who's being studied in these sections, you have people like Bayard Rustin. I mean, come on now.
Yep.
Like, it's still there. If you look hard enough, you'll see that it's still there.
Yep. And I think that level of detail is, again, from my end, so appreciated, but also so needed in the day in which you said of how important media companies are, mass communication is, and ensuring leaders like yourself, but also citizens, have access to what's actually in there and what's not in there to dispel any myths.
Be honest, right? Honesty is huge. And the more I stay in the media space, the more I realize that it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum a person is on, which it really took me. Mm. Because the way that they were attacking the College Board, to me, I was like, oh my goodness, you know, are they doing this for clicks? Mm. Because if they write a title a certain way, it's like the College Board is caving to Ron DeSantis's, you know, demands. And I don't think that that's necessarily what happened.
Can you share more? Is it just that what happened is they took some of that and they did some edits, but still stayed mostly true to the original writing? Is that fair?
I think that they just masked it in a certain way. Mm. So some of the bigger publications, you know, they were making broad claims that, well, they removed bell hooks. They removed Black Lives Matter. But the thing is that they removed all of the authors. Mm. Right? It wasn't just bell hooks. They literally did that intentionally. And they made it to where a student could be able to study any of those people. Right? And I think that's key information that a lot of people don't have. Mm-hmm. Even governors don't have that key information. And I felt, you know, it's media has to do a better job at explaining that. I was up all night, literally just trying to, you know, figure out what was going on because it was bothering me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you don't mind sharing more, like, how do you push your team to continue to kind of toe the line of honesty and clarity, and also other leaders in the space that maybe are on the same aisle or different aisle as you, to make sure they're holding true to honesty with the privilege that you guys have around reporting?
Well, I will definitely say it's difficult. Hmm. Because when the New York Times article came out, we were completely confused because we almost had a completely different article than they did, right?
Wow. Yeah.
But Politico and the Black Wall Street Times, we had very similar articles in the New York Times and some of the other bigger media conglomerates. They had a different version of what they saw. So, yeah, this is super interesting. But to be compared to Politico and hear from the College Board, well, you know, your publication and Politico got it right. I think that's pretty cool.
So. It is. That speaks, I think, to your work and your focus on honesty, but also the whole tagline around not just access, but access to materials and information that are right and just.
Right.
And you also kind of still related to your writing, but separately a little bit from the Black Wall Street Times, a pretty powerful article put out with on the Kauffman Foundation on their website as well, focused on investing in Black founders, and love the information you put in about O.W. Gurley and his work in the community as well. To really, I think what you said could be considered the first Black venture capitalist, maybe on record, right, in history,
yeah,
at least in America. Can you share more about that?
Since getting into this whole raising capital stage, like the Black Wall Street Times is not a nonprofit. We're a for-profit organization with hopes of raising capital to be able to expand our news efforts. Maybe the same size as The Root and The Grail, or maybe even bigger, right?
Yep.
I learned a lot about this venture capital space and found that Black founders aren't being invested in at the same rates. And it's the American motif, right? When it comes to Black people, there's always some disparity whenever you're looking at data. And so expectedly, we see that Black founders aren't having the same rates of success when it comes to raising capital for their businesses.
And hopefully articles like that, but at groups like Kauffman and others are helping increase and diversify that funding to more Black founders across the country. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that Google has an initiative around funding Black and minority owned businesses, even those in the LGBTQIA plus community. And I'm hoping that we continue to see more of that. That's the culture I hope that America's business community continues to explore.
Yeah, we've been fortunate to have leaders like Aaron Walker of Camelback on the podcast, and I know that's a lot of what their work is focused on. We're familiar with Echo and Green and some of their work as well, and so that I think we'd all probably agree it's not enough, but I really appreciate their work and their leadership for what they're doing to help increase that funding.
Yeah.
And Jason, your friend, submitted a guest question, asked you a little bit of a tough one, but I think you can probably handle it if that's cool with you.
Yeah, let's see what he said.
So Jason B. Allen asked if you could just talk more about what you've seen in your experience regarding the connection between foundations and funders supporting nonprofits who are doing the actual work on the ground day by day.
So I will say that not all foundations, right? Because there's this whole philanthropic industrial complex that's going on. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of wrong things that are happening. But there, I feel like there's a change. And I would say like the change started probably during the summer of 2020, right? When George Floyd was murdered on live television. That people realize that, you know what, maybe those who are the closest to the issues need to have more autonomy, or maybe even full autonomy, when it comes to solving those issues. In the past, you have the philanthropic community getting in the way, right? Thinking that they know best because they have these elite educations. But I've noticed that there's been a change, and at least in my community in Tulsa, it seems like a lot of the two biggest philanthropic foundations are doing a better job at listening to the local leaders and investing in their missions.
And can you offer maybe one or two practices, things they are doing or maybe should be doing that you've seen across the country to do a better job of listening and engaging and funding community members that are closest to the problem, most proximate to the problem?
Yeah, I would say those, you know, who have the track records, if I could speak directly to funders, mm-hmm. I would say if you know, and you can do your research, right? You don't want to just blindly write a check and be like, here, go do something great with it. But if you see, like I'll name the Terrence Crutcher Foundation in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Before there was any type of funding, they were already doing the work. So you know that if you give them the funding, that it's going to produce results.
Sure.
That's true with the Black Wall Street Times too. People were like, oh, he's writing about these big issues and he doesn't have any funding whatsoever. Mm-hmm. He's really passionate and really cares and consistent. Mm-hmm. Right. And so since receiving the funding, we get to expand, we get to hire more people, we get to have more reach and build relationships with other folks that want to be a part of the change that we seek.
So that advice is almost having funders be intentional about who's already doing the work rather than asking others to start something new. We probably somewhere in Tulsa, other markets we work in, there's almost like an oversaturation of nonprofits, right?
Yeah.
So figure out where there's opportunities for leaders already doing the work and mm-hmm. just help pour some positive gasoline on the fire.
That's where you go wrong, right? When you start trying to reinvent the wheel, you mess mm-hmm. up. You find people that, oh, well, you know, I'm moving to another city. I'm doing this, you know, I have another opportunity to grow my career. You want to find people that are dedicated to the work. Mm-hmm. They're dedicated. If you give them the money, they're going to stay and they're going to be invested because they want to see the positive outcomes of their work. So,
and I think fortunately, correct me if I'm wrong, what we've seen with some of our work too is recently, as you've alluded to, funders are more open to listening to like the metrics and the benchmarks and the goals mm-hmm. from those that are already doing the work, rather than kind of prescribing, here's what my foundation needs to say we do or hit in order to be successful. So at least from our work and supporting our clients, it's been, we've been optimistic about that sort of autonomy and power being exchanged back to those that are funding.
Yeah.
Then maybe a little bit on a lighter note, the Black Wall Street Times, I think, did a great job of live tweeting the Grammys on Sunday, checking out some of that as well. So, you know, maybe give us a few takeaways from the Grammys based upon your guys' live tweets.
Yeah. So to be completely honest, I was probably already asleep and in my bed when it was taking place. But, you know, it just speaks to, you know, the team that we have, that we've built. And we wouldn't have been able to do that without supporters. So, yeah, I was asleep the entire time.
For you. Good. Good.
And I saw these tweets and, you know, I saw that we got more followers and congratulated the two staff members that were live tweeting the Grammys. I think we're probably going to do some tweeting for the State of the Union too. We usually do.
That's great. Well, shout out to you for providing the leadership, but also specifically to those team members for holding it down.
Yeah.
And being awake on a Sunday.
Right.
Okay.
That's my bedtime, so I had to get into bed.
I mean, hey, we're on the same page there. Earlier I can get to bed, the better. So we got that in common. Okay. Hopefully a few rapid fire fun questions before you get out. What's one thing our listening audience can do to support the Black Wall Street Times?
I would say that if you're broke, you can simply subscribe to the Black Wall Street Times because all of those numbers do add up. Mm-hmm. But if you do have the financial resources, you can support us monetarily by donating $19.21 mm-hmm. To the Black Wall Street Times. And you could do that monthly, you can do that annually, or you can just do a one-time donation.
That's great. I know you were asleep during the Grammys, but curious what musical artist you're listening to at the moment.
That is a hard one. I don't know. What am I listening to? Oh, that's such a hard question for me to answer.
Okay, we can come back to it.
I just feel like I'm a boring person and I'm always thinking about how to make the world better. So I hardly ever, you know, stop to think about, oh, let's just listen to some music. Like if I'm in my car, I'm listening to NPR. So okay. Just a very boring person.
I mean, I wouldn't say anything you've done or shared is boring, but I understand you're maybe listening to other things besides music that are consuming you day by day.
But I do listen to music, though. So
yeah, I trust you. I'll believe you in that. Last question. What does Square Pizza remind you of?
Square Pizza? Ninja Turtles.
Ninja Turtles. Interesting. Yeah. My favorite cartoon growing up.
Yeah, I always think about... anytime I think about pizza, I'm thinking about the Ninja Turtles eating pizza and ordering it. So,
did you have a favorite Ninja Turtle?
I think Michelangelo was probably
Michelangelo. Favorite. Yeah, he was a leading candidate for me too. Good to hear. Mr. Frank, we appreciate this. I know you're a busy dude, so we'll let you go. But any final words for the audience?
Follow the Black Wall Street Times.
There you go. I will make sure we put in the show notes and throw you guys some subscribers and some followers. Thanks for all you do and thanks for joining.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for checking out the Square Pizza Pod, making a few selfish requests. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps spread the word about the podcast and share this with a friend. We appreciate it. Thanks.